Hello and welcome back to the Mobile Chicanes. My name is Naveen Razeek. Alongside me, it's Joshua Carroll-Walden. We've got plenty to talk about over the past few weeks of motorsport because we've had an off week last week. However, our top story was always going to be this one story. Fernando Alonso's IndyCar test to compete in the Indy 500 at Indianapolis. The biggest Formula One story, but also the least Formula One story you would possibly be able to get. He had a private test on Wednesday last week, and he did pretty well. I think he surprised everyone with sort of how smoothly it went, Josh. It certainly was the perfect way to kick off his Indy 500 campaign.
Yeah, for sure. And Alonso did everything he needed to do. Like, you know, he met all the speed targets. He was very comfortable with the way Indy, you know, just run their rookie programs, and was also very comfortable in raising his average speed and dealing with the smaller amounts of downforce as the day went on. So, yeah, you know, he was very comfortable at Indy, and also as well, you know, it was just a huge event globally, as this particular test did set. I think it would have set the all-time record in terms of total viewers for an actual motorsport test of any kind of in any series across the world, with 2.1 million views by the time the Facebook and YouTube live streams ended, and that's only counting the amount of views that the official IndyCar Facebook and official IndyCar YouTube streams got. There would have been a few more streams that weren't counted as a result of that. And obviously, in the last, you know, week or so, that has gone up. I think it's around 2.5 million total views right now since people have gone back and watch the key moments again, most noticeably the bird strike. And also as well, there were 60,000 people that constantly watched the test. So, it didn't go below 60,000 people for one moment of the 3 to 4 hour test. So those are some enormous numbers, and IndyCar certainly wouldn't even have dreamed about that 24 months ago.
Yes, and that's the big thing. This is an extraordinary development for IndyCar. Not necessarily a sustainable strategy to get growth in the sport, but it certainly introduced a lot of people who wouldn't have even known about IndyCar to it. And yeah, the publicity they get is absolutely astonishing. And it helped that Fernando Alonso had a pretty solid test as well. Michael Andretti was very impressed. They sailed through rookie orientation. He was even, and this was something Will Buxton picks up, he was running very aggressive lines. He was actually coming right up to the white line on the inside of the oval, which you usually don't see people do. So he's already trying to explore the limits. Dario Franchitti, who said earlier before the test that keep expectations realistic, he said he was amazed by Alonso's performance. I guess just sort of how quickly and how simply he did. His fastest lap speed was 222.458 miles per hour. Not necessarily up there with full Indy 500 speed, but that was a first test, and he will get used to figuring out how to set up this car later on, which is going to be the question as they start preparing for the Indy 500 qualifying in a couple of weeks' time. Gilles de Ferran said that it's that things aren't going to exactly... it's not going to be as good as that first test. He said that the perfect drama-free day will probably be the only day Alonso gets. But still, it's a welcome break for him, in particular, Fernando Alonso, because it's probably the first time in about 3 years he's been able to drive a car which hasn't broken down on him, which I guess would just be a normal morale boost for him. And you can see that he's really enjoying it.
Yeah, for sure. And like the Indy 500 rookie day that he participated in, you know, it would have been, you know, just what he's been, you know, wanting for so long. Like, you know, just a day at the track, driving a race car, you know, just doing that all day. Like, I mean, you know, in F1 in the previous years, like, there's always been dramas for himself, and, you know, he's had to, you know, basically sit on the sidelines and watch every other car fly by. And, you know, this time, you know, he just, you know, had a day at the track, which is just what drivers love. You know, that's what they, you know, do in their downtime. That's what they do in the off season. They just go to a track and drive a car around it all day. So, yeah, it would be a very good morale boost for Alonso. And yeah, I think he's, you know, really looking forward to this. I think, you know, he's thinking to himself that he's made a fantastic call and to go at a fantastic time.
Yeah, probably the first time in a while he's made a very good call. And he might possibly repeat it up next year. We'll talk more IndyCar later on in the show. We will head, though, first to Formula One. The Spanish Grand Prix kicks off on Sunday, the first race of the European leg of the championship. And that's really where we get to see a good... and Spain in particular is where we'll get to see a really good look at where every single team is. Because we still don't know who's better with Ferrari and Mercedes with these first four races, three of which have been on Hermann Tilke tracks, and most of which have been on tracks which are somewhat difficult for overtaking. Spain won't exactly change that, unfortunately, but we'll have to see how we go. Before we have a look at where the teams will end up, there's been a lot of talk about Pirelli's tyres for this year. In particular, the fact that the tyres have gotten harder, and in fact, the hard tyre might be perhaps too hard. I mean, Daniel Ricciardo has said that the hard compound that has been picked for the Spanish Grand Prix won't be really any good with anyone. I mean, the question, if it's so hard that they can't even get it up to temperature, then you're going to have real issues with, I guess, running it. And yeah, you can see teams just trying to ditch it as soon as possible, which could, that's a really bizarre element to the strategy, Josh.
Yeah, it is. And teams will investigate it in depth this Friday throughout free practice one and two. And yeah, if that's the case, then it's basically going to be a flashback to 2015, where it's just, you know, the option in prime tyres with softs and mediums. So, yeah, and that will cause a lot of alarm bells for Pirelli, as I think the next hard tyre compound race will be Silverstone. So, yeah, like that they really do need to get the act together if Ricciardo's fears are true. So, yeah, it's a bit of a wait and see game, and yeah, with the new tyre compounds, you know, we don't really know what to expect in terms of strategy. Like, I think it's either going to be two stops, and there will be some teams hopefully being able to stretch it to a one stop. They'll determine that at the end of Friday. So, yeah, it is very much a wait and see game, and definitely, the times that they'll set this coming weekend will be very interesting to see where they stack up compared to their pre-season testing times.
Yeah, and the big team in question this weekend will have to be Red Bull. Where do they fit out at the moment? Because they're planning to bring some major aero changes to that car this for this race. They're not bringing any engine changes, I think, at all. Well, I'm not even sure if they're going to make it to Canada. I think Renault are still working on that. But this is a car which has been plagued by poor reliability, probably the worst, least reliable car Red Bull have produced in their time in Formula One, which is certainly saying something. But yeah, it's not a great look for them. They're going to be throwing the kitchen sink at this one to try and fix it. Josh, do you think they will be able to get back on the pace, or is it possibly another wasted year? This is turning out to be a lot like 2015 for them.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I certainly don't expect Red Bull to take out the Constructors or Ricciardo or Verstappen to take out the Drivers' Championship this year. Like, that's, you know, already been ruled out. And realistically, the only goal left for them would be to win a few Grand Prix before the end of the season. And yeah, I think it's too early to tell. What their brain sounds promising. However, you know, I just feel like that the whole car itself needs to be improved. So it could be the case that you know, it's straight back to 2015, where the car is great at places like Monaco and great in the tight corners, but is absolutely miles behind on the straights behind Ferrari and Mercedes. So we could see, you know, confirmation that it is 2015 all over again. And yeah, that's a real big worry for Red Bull, because, you know, this is the first year of the new regulations, and next year's car will be an evolution on this year's car. So it really doesn't look good for them when they're right on the back foot.
Ryan Walkinshaw, another really good
the highlights now for race number 8 of the championship.
Where to from now?
There's a fair bit of bump and grind going on down at turn 1. Another excellent start by Mark Winterbottom, but unfortunately,
yeah, the positive thing is that during the race, he had some really good speed out of Scotty. His second set, even though he's been flying, he had top 6 pace all the way through.
Bit of a moment here for Craig Lowndes, who was tagged by Alex Rubio.
He's gone wrong this weekend, some promising
results. He was on his way to the pit
in his break list, and he lost all of his pace. JC was really, really good.
We want to see this team back up the front just anyway, as much as you guys do.
Anyway, yeah, that's
thanks, Ryan.
You know, a real, big accomplishment for DJR Tim Penske. And yeah, like, you know, the sky's the limit for them, basically. As you know, the FGX, you know, as a base model, as a base product, it is a real, it is very, very fast. And you know, we've seen that in the past, thanks to ProDrive. And now they've got Ludo behind them. And yeah, it really is. You know, that, like, it's all up for grabs for them. And yeah, now you know, we are in May now, so we're hand deep in the championship. We've now got 5 genuinely serious championship contenders that I think are all within 31 points of each other, which is, you know, it's amazing. And you know, that's, you know, a very, you know, big breath of fresh air when you consider that championship battles in the past are mainly between 2 drivers, sometimes 3. And now to have 5 drivers in the mix, with the wild card being Chaz Mostert, who has been, you know, consistent but quiet so far this year, but certainly does have the potential to get a race win here or there. So 5 championship contenders. 2 of them haven't won races, being Jamie Whincup and Chaz Mostert. And then you've got Mark Winterbottom and Garth Tander, surprisingly, in the background within 200 points of Fabian Coulthard. So yeah, it's a fantastic breath of fresh air to have so many championship contenders. But then again, there is a long way to go, and you know, just the sheer brutality of the Supercars Championship will weed out 1 or 2 very good and unfortunately very deserving championship threats.
Yeah, it's certainly another interesting weekend. Sort of there was no safety cars during the races, which was quite interesting. And because of that, I think everybody played the strategy hand a little too well. I mean, we know that we've seen some crazy pit strategies in the past reap dividends, particularly, of course, Craig Lowndes move last year. But there was nothing like that this year. They all sort of stayed in the right place. But there's still some decent racing. So overall, a pretty solid weekend. It wasn't free of controversy, though. We had another major controversy breakout over the weekend, particularly involving qualifying, which was, yeah, what something that we still need to get sorted. I mean, Supercars, they haven't had a weekend where they haven't had something go wrong. And in this case, it was a very unique set of circumstances involving the warm-up laps for qualifying. On everybody's outlap, a lot of the cars, in particular the Nissans, were really slowing up on the back straight, which is it's a very difficult track of road because it comes up the hill and straight down. And we saw in qualifying 1, Shane van Gisbergen get fired off into the gravel trap at the end because he found his way completely blocked and he didn't expect it. because of how slow everybody was. And Simona Di Silvestro ultimately got charged with a penalty. She was one of the Nissans involved. There also, I think, Todd Kelly and Michael Caruso. It is something that is it something that we need to fix, Josh? Because do we need a proper go zone for this kind of stuff? Because it is a very unique problem. It only happens at Barbagella because it's so short, but it's also very dangerous and very narrow there. So, yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, this is a problem that's certainly not new. Like, it's been around for, 10 years, maybe more. Like, I mean, you know, I've grown up, you know, watching, you know, supercars and, you know, at some point in every season, you know, this always pops up. So, yeah, like, maybe it is time to put in a go zone, you know, just have, you know, do something like what NASCAR does, you know, with just, you know, paint, you know, a section of the wall, you know, towards the top of the hill, you know, that, you know, is basically saying go zone, and then put, you know, a thick green strip of paint, you know, right across the track. So, yeah, like, I mean, it is difficult. Like, there were some proposals thrown up, you know, split qualifying, but then again, if you do split qualifying, you do disadvantage the 13 cars that do go out first, because the track will be much more rubbered up and much quicker for the second group of 13 that goes out straight afterwards. So I think realistically the only solution really is a go zone, and, you know, if you don't go in the go zone, then basically, you know, you get a grid penalty for that upcoming race for that particular qualifying session determined. So, yeah, I think that's the solution, and fortunately, it is something that can be pretty easily policed. Like, I mean, I don't expect, you know, the timeline from incident to penalty being handed out being more than 30 minutes. So, it is something that they need to have a look at, and yeah, just it'll improve the qualifying spectacle, because, you know, we always, you know, walk away wonder what might have been, you know, when these types of incidents occur, and, you know, it's just, you know, a byproduct of, you know, what supercars you know is and is trying to be, because typically on the shorter tracks is where you get the best racing for supercars. And obviously, you know, it's great to have as many supercars as possible and reach capacity as many circuits as possible, and that's just this is just a bright byproduct of that ambition. So, yeah, I think a go zone needs to be, you know, put in place. NASCAR do it really, really well, and it wouldn't take much. Like, it would only take, you know, 2 weeks maximum to figure out all the fine details and to get it and to put and to get the paintbrushes out and to complete it. So, yeah, it wouldn't take much, and something to look into, as I don't think there'll be any more issues of that this year with Simmons Plains and Barbagallo out of the way. Like, it doesn't really happen at, like, the Gold Coast or anywhere like that, and it doesn't happen at Pukekohe either, because of the general nature of the circuit itself. So, certainly something to look into come Simmons Plains and Barbagallo this time next year. Hopefully it gets... Well, it's not a pressing issue, but it's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was listening to some of the coverage, and they were running a metric, and they said each car has really only got about 60 meters of space to play with on the track if you're all trying to fit into that back straight. And I think things are going to get very interesting when we head to Queensland Raceway, where we have a 30... car grid. I think there's going to be some very interesting stuff going on at the back during that. Now, meanwhile, let's head off to one of the teams that has been struggling so far, HSV Racing, formerly HRT Racing, the Walkinshaw outfit. Another disappointing week, and James Courtney apologising to fans after he struggled to finish in the top 15. I mean, he ended up finishing 17th and 22nd in both races. When he had to pit for fuel late because he realised that they hadn't reached a minimum fuel drop. Scott Pye didn't go any better either. I mean, it seems like Garth Tanner's decision to leave the team was a bit of a masterclass. It still got him racing competitively. So what is this Walkinshaw team struggling with? Because they are now, you could argue, the fourth best team. If we put GRM and Erebus, who are now sort of duking out for second and third with who would be the other team?
Pride Drive, yep.
Who would you put? Are they possibly slinking down towards Lucas Dumbrell levels? Because they just really are struggling, and it shows the fact that they've lost their money shows that the issue still appears to be with the team, and I guess the lack of funding doesn't really help that, does it?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, HSB Racing and Walkinshaw, you know, they're just a team that really does struggle and, you know, just falls off the face of the planet when we head to these types of races at Barbagallo, and I expect at Winton their problems will continue to struggle, as they only really shine at street races and Bathurst. That's the only places that they really, you know, just are competitive. And also as well, like, I mean, you know the chassis James Courtney raced at Barbagallo last weekend was the same chassis that Garth Tander raced before he got his new chassis. And that particular chassis, you know, was it was the one where, you know, it was involved in a big accident. I can't remember when, but it was involved in a big accident. And from there on in, you know, it was just not competitive. And any setup that he threw at it, you know, just didn't work. So, and James Courtney, you know, since Barbagallo has been echoing the same concerns that Garth Tander echoed when, you know, he just realised that, you know, this chassis just will not, you know, get any more race wins. And, you know, very, you know, concerningly, Ryan Walkinshaw has, you know, brushed off these claims. And, yeah, he's just causing more future pain for himself. And, you know, if James Courtney is going to be stuck with this chassis heading into next season, then, you know, it's going to give him the major incentive then to look elsewhere, because, you know, if your team is not going to listen to you and provide you with a chassis that's actually got the capability to be competitive, then you might as well, you know, go drive for another team. So, a very concerning stuff from Ryan Walkinshaw, you know, just not really addressing any of the speed concerns, and, you know, just having the mentality of just being happy to be there and being happy of what they are. But, you know, they're not who they are for just, you know, brushing off concerns and, you know, just sticking out the back of the pack in the midfield. So, yeah, they really need to have a long, hard look at themselves, and, you know, I think they just need to have a bigger, you know, a big look at their morals and their ambitions, as, you know, it's just not working for them right now. And I don't know what they're doing in terms of, you know, building new chassis, but, you know, realistically, you know, I would be getting James Courtney into a brand new chassis, you know, even if it's an older one, for, you know, one or two rounds, you know, even if it's an older one, just get him out of that terrible chassis, as, you know, he certainly won't get any podiums with that chassis. Like, it will have to take a freak race for James Courtney to get a podium with that chassis.
Yeah, the only thing I could possibly think is that they're just holding off and saving money to buy a new Super Commodore chassis next year, the new 2018 model. Should be the only thing, but yeah, it doesn't look good. And people think, the team needs to remember they still have loyal fans. I mean, they don't have the HRT brand, but they are still HRT to, I guess, the vast majority of the HRT fans out there, the outfit. And they weren't impressed with the showing. I mean, they put up with it when they were holding, and I think they were still running competitively, but things seem to be reaching new lows. So, yeah, it's not great. You have to say, James Courtney is slowly building his case to becoming the next the Fernando Alonso of supercars. You know, he's a skilled driver, just stuck at the wrong team at the wrong time. Let's move on now back to IndyCar. We're not going to talk much about Fernando Alonso. We're still going to be talking about the races coming up, including some races that might be coming up in the next few years, including some propositions for IndyCar to get out of America and possibly head back to another international expansion. In particular, Mark Miles has been chatting with some Chinese investors and backers about the possibility for a Chinese race. Of course, this is the market that has been wanted by everyone, pretty much. Like Formula One pretty much opened their supercars, have had one round, and might possibly go back sometime in the future. We also have rounds that, well, DTM ran one round, I think, in 2003 as well. The WEC are in there, as well as the World Touring Car Championship. Plenty of action, of course, at the Shanghai International Circuit, which is the main one. And new IndyCar looks to be getting into the action, as we've also talked about IndyCar in the past, in particular street circuits and the like. However, they're saying it's very premature, the discussions at the moment. The race may not happen until 2019. But you have to say, Josh, that I think it's about the time where IndyCar is sort of reaching the critical mass where they can possibly get away with putting together an international race. And if there's one market they really do need to conquer, and I guess the manufacturers would be keen to conquer, it would have to be China, wouldn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And China's, you know, just a very, you know, it's the land of opportunity. And, you know, we've seen with Formula One, you know, how much the Chinese Grand Prix and the Shanghai International Circuit itself has grown since they first went there in the early to mid 2000s. Also as well, there are a lot of opportunities on the table right now for IndyCar, as Mark Miles was talking before Alonso's rookie test, that quite a few European races, you know, he did mention, you know, going to Britain, you know, the possible return to Holland, and then he also mentioned Italy. So there are a lot of opportunities on the table. There's also talk, which has been going, well, there's been a lot of talk going on for a long time about a race in Mexico, as the current proposal is to race at a 1.25 mile oval about 100 miles southeast of Mexico City itself. So interesting that they've sort of, you know, ditched the Mexico City F1 track for an oval. So, you know, maybe that's just, you know, the direction they want to take. And there's also more talk about in the second Canadian race, IndyCar race, which, you know, certainly, you know, looks like a good opportunity, because after the US, of course, you know, Canada has always been very interested in IndyCar at any time throughout IndyCar's life cycle. And also just some races at Portland, just to cover all the bases and being as spread out as possible right across the US, the main US states. So yeah, there's a lot of opportunities on the table. It could potentially work for them. Like, Europe would get quite a bit of attention, and if IndyCar does decide to go to either Britain or Italy, then, you know, it would get a lot of coverage, but, you know, it would also generate quite a lot of nervous fans, because they are going directly into F1 heartland, where Grand Prix are deemed a failure when Grand Prix race day crowd figures are less than 100,000 people. So it would create a lot of media interest if they decide to go after the F1 heartland of Britain and Italy. There'd be a lot of nervous people, you know, just hoping that it actually works. So, yeah, and China as well, like, China's a bit, you know, it's a bit weird, like, you know, with the way China works, because, you know, obviously, you know, F1, you know, it's got a stable base right now, but, you know, when, you know, series go to, you know, street circuits in China, you know, they just don't, for some reason, you know, it just doesn't create the same effect as, you know, as, you know, anywhere else in the world, where you take the race to the people. Like, you know, for some reason, you know, the Chinese fans, you know, they just don't, you know, show up to the races like they do to the Chinese Grand Prix at Shanghai. So, yeah, it is the land of opportunity, and IndyCar do have a lot of options on the table. Also, as well, this does beg the question about what the future is going to be like for the actual IndyCar schedule, as, you know, there will be, you know, some angst against removing some of the US races that they've got on the calendar right now, because you know, IndyCar has been going on, you know, it has been, you know, appeasing their fans quite a bit over the past few years with the additions of the classic IndyCar races like Watkins Glen, Road America, and the like. So, yeah, there are a lot of options ahead for IndyCar, and hopefully they make the right decisions.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I guess Portland would be an obvious one. If anything, people wonder why it hasn't happened sooner. I mean, it hosted kart, Champ Car slash Kart pretty much all the way up until the series merged, and it never really got another look in after that. And I'm guessing, I'm not sure how up to date the facilities would be, but they wouldn't be too bad if they were still hosting up until 2007. So that's an obvious one in there. I guess international, it always depends, of course, on what's happening with the television deals and the TV rights overseas, which is something that's going to come up later this year, because the talks at ESPN, they currently produce the international coverage as well as the coverage for the 500, the opening race, or pretty much everything in the month of May, plus the odd race in Detroit as well. They're looking at bailing out of their coverage, and what will happen with the international feed is still yet to be determined. So we don't know what's going on there, and if there's a way that IndyCar can get some more airtime, either through some possible free-to-air exposure like they did back in the old golden days when Champ Car was able to get four races on the Channel 10. Imagine that, yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens overseas. In particular, I guess China is, in the case of China and Formula One, the races are carried, I think, on free-to-air television. It's heavily localized, but you could still watch them. So I guess that's sort of got the critical mass, and you've got that middle-class demographic who are now into the motorsports and to the automotive culture, which we haven't seen really in China for about, ever since, we've only really seen since the 1990s, I guess. So yeah, it's all still a big question to see exactly how IndyCar go. But you have to say they need to make sure they don't. If the series is not broken at the moment, if anything, it's at its best. Although I still think that needs to be fixed. But in terms of the scheduling, I think that they've really hit the spot this year, and you need to be careful not to tip things over the edge when it comes to next year. So of course, this weekend, well, we are in the month of May at the moment, and that means that this weekend we are heading to Indianapolis for the first race there, not on the oval, but on the road course, which of course runs in the opposite direction. It's currently, I think, it's a combination of the Formula One road course and the MotoGP course that MotoGP used to run there. It's had some decent racing. Of course, the first race of 2014 was filled with controversy because they tried to do a standing start and failed miserably. But it's slowly managed to get some decent following. It has a decent crowd numbers. I mean, 30,000 is not super great. It doesn't look great when you see the colossal stands of Indy, but I guess it's very good for people, and I guess it's an added incentive, and I think there'll be a lot of European fans who will be coming over early, seeing the road race, and then sticking around to see the oval race with Fernando Alonso at the end of the month. But it's another important race. It's still a race as it is, and I think it's probably the best chance that Will Power will get to get a race win, because he has had some strong form at this track in the past, and I guess it will be the best place for him to get his season off to a good start, because whilst he's good at Indy, he's never actually won a race, and he's always struggled on the ovals, you'd have to say, Josh.
Yeah, for sure, and right now it's, you know, it is do or die for Will Power in terms of his championship hopes. Like, he needs to get back in the winner's circle, and you know, to win a race in IndyCar, and with Indianapolis having, you know, big points on offer with double points as well as qualifying, you know, he just needs to get a race win to keep himself in it, and you know, if he doesn't do well at Indianapolis at the road course, then you know, he might as well, you know, say goodbye to his championship hopes. So yeah, it really is crunch time, and also as well, this does mark the return of Juan Pablo Montoya, who will be racing at the road course in preparation for another Indy 500 assault on his part. So yeah, a lot to look forward to. Simon Pagenaud right now leads the championship stands, 18 points ahead of Scott Dixon, who continues to be very consistent and always up there. Joseph Newgarden is 26 points back, and Sebastian Bourdais for Dalcoyne Racing still putting in an amazing performance so far this year, being 31 points behind Simon Pagenaud in fourth place. So yeah, there's a lot to play for, and Yeah, leading into the month of May, you know, it's always good to get a win under your belt ahead of the very long build up to the Indy 500. So yeah, it really is crunch time.
Okay, yeah, so that will kick off early this Monday, that being the Indianapolis Grand Prix. Moving on to the world of NASCAR, and we've got a brand new winner, Ricky Stenhouse Jr., scoring his first Monster Energy Cup win, taking pole at Talladega Speedway. Another chaotic race, the big one came out again, and Stenhouse won it on the last lap. Another strong race at Talladega, the venue that I guess never fails to perform, Josh.
Yeah, for sure. And this was a very popular win. Like, many people have been waiting for Ricky Stenhouse Jr. to come through with that breakthrough win. And, he did well. And, he was, I think another thing that fans liked, he was very aggressive throughout the whole race. With Danica saying, in the paddock that if, Ricky wasn't gonna, win, then, he would, cause the big one. So, a fantastic, race weekend, and Kyle Busch once again coming up short, in terms of a race win. I don't think he's won a race, all year yet. No wins for Kyle Busch, but always up there in the top five and always finishing short and always missing out on getting the maximum stage points. And you gotta wonder how long can this last before he finally breaks through. He's just, you can almost call him cursed this whole season. So another fantastic race to Talladega. I think the series now moves on to Kansas, which hasn't produced the best racing ever, but it is notorious for the long green flag runs, which means that the stage system will help out slightly. And still Carl Larson, 54 points ahead of Martin Truex Jr. in second in the championship standings. Doing all he needs to do. He's got a commanding championship lead, but it's all really amounts to nothing when the chase rolls around. And Ricky Stenhouse, that win moves him up into 12th place and very well could seal the deal in terms of his chase berth. So all in all, a fantastic weekend for the next generation of NASCAR racers. And in the aftermath of Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s announced retirement, it just confirms that, this is a changing of the guard.
Yeah, it certainly is, and NASCAR will be looking to these young personalities to pretty much keep the series momentum going into the future now that we've lost some of the big names of the sport. So moving on to the world of MotoGP, another MotoGP return to Europe, kicking off their European leg. And it was Danny Pedrosa who took the win, fending off Marc Marquez. Jorge Lorenzo on the podium, their first strong result for him this year. Really disappointing weekend for the Yamahas and for Jack Miller, which of course will be the big talking point for the Australians. He was given a fine after being taken out by Alvaro, or colliding with Alvaro Bautista, and then giving him a bit of a shove right afterwards, which drew the ire of the stewards. So another disappointing weekend for Jack Miller. It's not really the start that he would have wanted this year.
No, and Jack Miller was riding on a high after the first three Grand Prix, it's really unfortunate that he's been involved in an incident. But given that the MotoGP season is 18 Grand Prix long, it was always going to happen. And this really does throw up the marbles in terms of who's a championship contender and who's not. With Danny Pedrosa, once again getting the win at Jerez. So it's very interesting championship situation right now, with Valentino Rossi finishing in 10th place. As it just seems like there's no particular form guide this season. With one race you can be right up there on the podium, and then the next you could be absolutely nowhere. So right now it's really honing up in the championship, with Valentino Rossi leading the way, 2 points ahead of Maverick Vinales, who didn't have a great weekend at Jerez, but it was okay. But, you know, he keeps himself in it. Mark Marquez now just 4 points behind Valentino Rossi. Daniel Pedrosa, he's now 10 points behind Rossi with that win. So, yeah, four series championship contenders. And, yeah, and then the midfield is always as crazy and as unpredictable as ever as they head to France next. At the Bugatti circuit, so that will be one to watch. Always a tight circuit that does produce quite a bit of drama, and realistically, you know, it's you know this form, this you know there's no real form guide for MotoGP this year, so it's all up in the air, and anyone can win.
Moving on in our quick sweep around the world of motorsport, we head of course to the World Endurance Championship in Belgium. The 6 hours of Spa, it saw a pretty predictable winner in that it was a Toyota. The number two car, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, the Toyota, or not the number two car, the number two Toyota took the victory. That was the car of, let me just get it up. So Sebastian Buemi, Kaz Nakajima, and Anthony Davison. Just beating out Mike Conway and Kamui Kobayashi's Toyota. They were pretty much running neck and neck until two full course yellows played to the hands of the number eight car. So yeah, another tense race, very close race between the two Toyotas, which at least means we've got some inter-team competition, if anything, even though the Porsches have really been off the pace, but they have been running some lower downforce, and exactly where that will play when we get to Le Mans is still the big question. They could still take the win there. Also a solid result for G-Drive in the LMP2 class, and Ferrari, who dominated GTE, the 51 and 71, both dicing and swapping positions all around and almost tripping over some of the other cars in the process. But yeah, another thrilling race. If anything, though, the disappointing thing is that we still don't... It does look like it's going to be a one-team race, which is not necessarily what we like in the WEC, because we like it when we have a nice development race between two teams. And like last year, which was perfect, in which we had all three teams pretty much evenly matched. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's going to happen this year.
Yeah, for sure. And it is a shame. Like, I mean, throughout the whole weekend, you know, Toyota would, you know, have a problem or bad luck, and then the Porsches would capitalize and, you know, take the lead for a bit. But then once those issues were sorted, Toyota always came back and overtook them for the lead and then for the win. So... yeah, it's looking like a Toyota victory at Le Mans, but then we've said that in the past, and you know they've always managed to stuff it up. So yeah, in terms of Toyota, like they really would want to, you know, really, you know, nail every single aspect of Le Mans after what happened last year. You know, just breaking down on the final lap. So yeah, just it's, you know, certainly going to be interesting to see if they can, you know, finally get through for that Le Mans victory. Also in GT Pro, Ferrari right now, you know, they're just looking so dominant, and they've certainly gotten the better of all the Ford teams running the Ford GT. It looks like another Ferrari Le Mans victory. And then in GTM, it is, as ever, more Aston Martin domination. As you know, their car's just been in a fantastic spot ever since the second half of last season. So, yeah, it is looking, you know, pretty, you know, all said and done. However, Le Mans is a totally different beast compared to all the other events that the World Endurance Championship goes to. And, it certainly will be a good race, but you know it might be, you know, a one way fight.
Yeah, moving on of our final pretty much sport we've got to cover. I think every football almost talk about everything this weekend. We head off for Formula E, which springs back into life for the Monaco E-Prix. There's a couple of injury concerns we're currently looking at the moment. Jose Maria Lopez is in doubt, whilst Alexander Sims is on standby for Robin Frains in Monaco. It's going to be another interesting race. Monaco's produced some interesting racing with Formula E in the past. Very tight, very sort of congested racing, and with some big crashes in the past. We'll be interested to see what happens this year. Of course, some of the interesting news coming out of Formula E is that the Newcastle City Council here in Australia might be looking at a Formula E bid. Of course, they are hosting supercars later this year, but they look like they might be trying to bolster their motorsport credentials, and particularly a green motorsport, which I guess could possibly appease some of the rather annoyed locals who have been making headlines over the last few weeks, Josh.
I'm not sure what to think about this, because it would be very interesting to see how they work, Formula E and supercars, on the one weekend. Like, from everything I've heard, Formula E would be the support category for supercars for the weekend, obviously with the majority of Newcastleians, or whatever they call themselves, preferring...
Novocastrians, I think it is.
Okay. Preferring supercars over Formula E. And, I just don't know. As a Formula E, you know, it just hasn't really taken off in Australia yet. As, you know, the races are always at a poor time of day. And, Formula, you know, FIA sanctioned categories never really, you know, capture the general Australian motor enthusiast imagination. So, yeah, also as well, there are a few concerns, you know, with Newcastle track, you know, just having too many straights and not being tight enough for me. But, yeah, like, you know, since that announcement, we haven't really heard that much. However, you know, we don't really hear that much in terms of e-pre bids, as, you know, it's always, you know, done behind the scenes and out of the public eye. So, yeah, it would be very interesting, and but then again, it would be, you know, the perfect opportunity for Formula E to break into the Australian motorsport market. So, yeah, hopefully, you know, if it does work, that'll be great for Formula E, and it, you know, would help supercars a bit as well. So, yeah, you know, it'll be interesting to see what becomes of this proposal, as, you know, there are a lot of cities right around the world lining up to try and get Formula E to come to their side of the world. So, yeah, it just adds to the mystery that is, what is the future of Formula E? What is the future of Formula E calendar going to look like? So, yeah, we'll just have to wait and see.
Yes, so a very busy weekend of motorsport coming up. We, of course, have NASCAR at Kansas, IndyCar at the Grand Prix of Indianapolis, Formula One in Spain, and Formula E in Monaco. Is going to be another exciting weekend. We'll wrap it all up next Tuesday in our next episode of the Mobile Chicanes. We will see you then. I've been Naveen Razik.
And I've been Josh Carroll.
And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.